We return to excerpts from the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration. This is from their culminating sessions on the weekend of January 20th, 2006. We hear now about destruction of the global environment, a summary from Ted Glick of the Climate Crisis Coalition.
From the time that the Bush administration came into office at the beginning of 2001, there have been a steady series of actions taken which unmistakably and clearly show evidence of a willful disregard of the assessment of the world, scientific community, indeed the governments of the world, that it is critical that action be taken now to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, as we have been hearing all this morning. The first action taken, as has been mentioned, was to withdraw the United States from the Kyoto Protocol process completely, even though the U.S., with 4% of the world's population, is responsible for nearly one quarter of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. Around the same time, the United States used its power to remove Dr. Robert Watson, the chief scientist of the World Bank. As chair, he was also chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The UN Association of 2,000 scientists that's been studying global warming since 1989. They had him replaced with Dr. Rajendra Pachauri, who was described by former Vice President Al Gore as the, quote, let's drag out our feet candidate. According to an article by Jeffrey Lean in the Independent newspaper on January 23, 2005, quote, a memorandum from Exxon to the White House in early 2001 specifically asked it to get the previous chairman, Dr. Robert Watson, replaced. The Bush administration then lobbied other countries in favor of Dr. Pachauri and got him elected to replace Dr. Watson, who had repeatedly called for urgent action. I'll mention that fortunately, Dr. Pachauri, when he got into office and learned the reality and the science of what was happening, apparently rather quickly came to be an advocate for the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Toward the end of 2004, following this whole period that Daphne Whisham talked about in terms of the censorship and the obstruction of the efforts to get out the truth to the American people about this crisis, towards the end of 2004, the United States stepped up its action on the world stage. It did so after Russia announced in the fall of that year that it would sign the Kyoto Protocol, which meant that enough countries had done so that it would now go into effect as of February 16, 2005. With that as an important backdrop, the U.S. delegation to an international negotiating session in Buenos Aires, in the words of Jeffrey Lean in The Independent, this was in December of 2004. The U.S. delegation, quote, brought the talks to the brink of collapse by obstructing even anodyne, meaning painless, proposals. This breached an assurance given by President Bush in 2001 when he pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol that America would not try to stop other countries reaching agreement. Then last year, from July 6th to 8th, the group of eight countries, the G8, met in Glen Eagles, Scotland. Prior to that meeting, there were, according to an article in the June 19th issue of The Observer, quote, extraordinary efforts by the White House to scupper, meaning destroy, Britain's attempts to tackle global warming, unquote. This is according to, quote, leaked U.S. government documents obtained by The Observer. These papers show how the United States over the past 2 months had been seriously undermining Tony Blair's proposals to tackle climate change. They show that Washington officials, quote, removed all reference to the fact that climate change is a serious threat to human health and to ecosystems, deleted any suggestion that global warming has already started, expunged any suggestion that human activity was to blame for climate change. It is therefore not surprising that there were no decisions made to undertake or support any significant concerted action coming out of the G8 summit. Finally, we have the evidence of the administration's obstructionist efforts at the United Nations Climate Conference in Montreal, which was attended by 10,000 delegates from over 180 countries, and which concluded a little more than a month ago on December 10th. As that conference began on November 28th, the chief U.S. climate negotiator, Harlan Watson, was quoted in a Reuters news story as saying, in reference to new ways to fight the buildup of greenhouse gases, that, quote, "the United States is opposed to any such discussions," unquote. This is the position they held to and the role that they played over the course of the 2 weeks of this important international conference. In the words of Andrew Revkin in a December 11th New York Times article, quote, "the United States spent much of the meeting opposing language aimed at starting fresh talks on ways to increase the effectiveness of the original 1992 Framework Convention," unquote. A front page article by Revkin on December 10th reported on the most dramatic example of the U.S. role, a, quote, "walkout" by Harlan L. Watson, the chief American negotiator here, came Friday, shortly after midnight, on what was to have been the last day of the talks, during which the administration has been repeatedly assailed by the leaders of other wealthy industrialized nations for refusing to negotiate to advance the goals of that treaty. At a closed session of about 50 delegates, Dr. Watson objected to the proposed title of a statement calling for long-term international cooperation to carry out the 1992 climate treaty, participants said. He then got up from the table and departed, unquote. To sum up, ladies and gentlemen of the jury and others listening, I would urge you to take all of the testimony we have put before you this morning and consider it very seriously. I believe we have presented compelling evidence that the U.S. government for the last 5 years has engaged in a deliberate, willful, and reckless course of action which is causing great damage to the ecosystem upon which all forms of life on this planet depend, whether plant, insect, animal, mammal, or human. The extensive disruption of the basis for all life, the destruction of our natural environment, done willfully and with full understanding of the consequences, is, I believe, the greatest crime that could ever be committed. I hope you will agree and that we will all act accordingly. Thank you.
We have one more segment to bring you from the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity Committed by the Bush Administration. This segment is of remarks by Anne Wright, former U.S. diplomat and retired U.S. Army Reserve colonel.
Next, I'd like to introduce a woman who was in the U.S. Army for 29 years and retired as a colonel. She was 16 years in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps and served in Somalia, Sierra Leone, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, and reopened the U.S. Embassy in Kabul, Afghanistan in December 2001. She was one of the three diplomats who resigned in March 2003 in opposition to the war in Iraq. And she now counts herself in the rank of the peacemakers, not the war makers. Please welcome Anne Wright.
Well, good evening. This is a very important event that we have here. It's time for us as citizens, on conscience, in conscience, to take some actions. I myself, I resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq 2.5 years ago. It didn't meet, to me, the qualifications of a war. A good war, a just war, and now all wars are bad. We didn't go to the United Nations Security Council to try to get an authorization for that war, because the United Nations Security Council wasn't about to give it to the United States for this, what everybody on the council knew was an illegal war. And in fact, there were, you know, I was one of three diplomats that resigned, but there were other people around the world that were resigning. Do you happen to know that the deputy legal counsel of the British equivalent to the State Department, their foreign and commercial office, she resigned in March of 2003, calling what was going to happen an illegal war of aggression. I mean, our nations have been put on notice that the Iraq war was going to be illegal. Okay, so I resigned, three others resigned here in America, others resigned in Britain, but our nations went to war. So now what do we as citizens do? What do we do now? Do we have these responsibilities? And Marcus says, yes, we do. And I totally agree with him. I think it's up to us now. We have got to be doing more acts of disobedience. We have got to show, we've got to take our government back. We've got to show our government that the people know what's right, because certainly this administration doesn't know what's right. A couple of days ago, I was listening to our new Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And Condoleezza Rice was in a rather arrogant and rude way, stiffing the U.S. Congress. They were asking legitimate questions of, do we have a plan for Iraq? Silence. No plan. What about, we've been hearing things about Syria and Iran. We've been hearing that the administration is discussing military options for Syria. And what was the comment from the Secretary of State? Only the second time that she had appeared before this committee, the first time being when she was confirmed in February of 2005. Her comment was essentially, it's none of your business. One senator said, well, you know, you do have to consult with the Congress. We did give you an authorization for Iraq, but we haven't given anything for Syria. Condoleezza Rice, our Secretary of State, essentially thumbed her nose at the Congress. Well, I, as a citizen now, not a federal government employee after 35 years, just an ordinary citizen sitting in that hearing room, thought, you know, these guys and gals in the Congress let us down before on Iraq. They sold us down the river. They were bamboozled by this administration. So I thought, well, you know, I've already given up my career on this war in Iraq, and I've now been arrested one time in front of the White House 2 weeks ago. Yay. Part of 373 people that were arrested. And were any of you arrested during that? Yes, well done, thank you. So I thought, well, here we go. I mean, I'm doing things I never thought I would do in my whole life. So I stood up in the middle of the congressional hearing and said, stop the killing, stop the war. You, the Congress, sold us down the river before. You cannot do this again. You can't let this woman be a part of a killing machine in Syria. Stop the war. Stop the war in Syria. Don't go into Iran. Well, so, I mean, this is the first time I'd ever done this before, and I didn't know that you have to plan these things ahead. You have to have, like, you know, 30 seconds or a minute of protest things, or you've got to have a whole group of people behind you. And I was hoping that you know, some of the people in the audience would take this up, you know, surely somebody here. Well, I heard some murmurs, but nobody started saying anything. So the policeman that was on the side of the, you know, the hearing room started coming toward me, and it was like, gosh, I wish you'd hurry up because I've run out of things to say. I've got to plan this better next time. So I started in the thing, you know, stop the war. Don't let her start another war here. Keep that woman. Don't let her. You know, and finally the policeman came up and said, oh, excuse me, you'd have to come with me. I said, okay, fine, I will. Well, everything was quiet. In the whole room, everything was still quiet. You think, well, I seem to have the attention, so I will go out in glory again. So it was, well, stop the killing, stop the war, you know, all the way out the door. And it was exhilarating. It wasn't scary. It wasn't scary at all. It was saying that on behalf of the people of the United States that we want the Congress. The Congress, you're the guys and gals that let this thing happen before, and you cannot let it happen again. So I appeal to you all. Go down to the Congress. Go down to Washington and sit every single time one of our senior leaders is giving testimony. And if you feel that the Congress is being bamboozled, if you as American citizens are being bamboozled, stand up right there and say so. I'll tell you, the Congress appreciates it because the chairman of that committee, Senator Lugar, could have had me arrested. They took me outside, had me, you know, give all the particulars, and then were waiting for a decision from the chairman of whether or not he wanted me arrested. About 5 minutes later, here came a policeman saying, the chairman does not want to have her arrested. So, how about that? So the Congress is looking for us to buck them up. I mean, they're not noted for their spines, and we are their spines. So please join me in Washington every time there's a congressional hearing on every issue of importance to us. And that seems to be everything that the Congress is talking about now. But particularly the war in Iraq. Please go down there and buck up the spine of the Congress. And by sitting on our behinds, that's not where it is. I mean, and I, as a you know, 35-year veteran of government employment, for me to be up here, standing here saying, you know, we got to take to the streets. We got to have a revolution. We got to do this civil disobedience, peaceful, nonviolent. But we've got to physically show this government that we want this war to end. This tribunal is great. I am so glad to be here. These are the charges. These are the indictments that ultimately, I believe, will bring this administration down. So thank you all so much for your spirit, and let's get some backbone and stop them. Thanks.
We've been listening over the past hour to reports from the International Commission of Inquiry on Crimes Against Humanity committed by the Bush administration. Their culminating sessions were held the weekend of January 20th, 2006, at Riverside Church and Columbia Law School. To hear much more of the testimony and their findings, go to www.bushcommission.org. You're listening to Making Waves. Now for our People's History section, we bring you Michael Parente speaking on Real Democracy.
This is Radio Truth, a series of commentaries by Dr. Michael Parente. Michael Parente is an activist and internationally known award-winning author and scholar. His recent books include The Assassination of Julius Caesar and Super Patriotism. His latest book, The Culture Struggle, will be released in November 2005. For further information, please visit his website, michaelparente.org.
Real Democracy. In a democracy, people should be able to enjoy freedom from economic as well as political oppression. In a real democracy, the material conditions of people's lives should be humane and not insufferable. Anatole France once wrote, "The law, in its majestic equality, prohibits rich and poor alike from stealing bread and begging in the streets. And so the law becomes something of a farce, a fiction that allows us to speak of the rights of all, divorced from the class conditions that often place the rich above the law and the poor way below it. In the absence of certain material conditions, formal rights are of little value to millions who lack the means to make a reality of their rights. Take the idea that every citizen has a right to be heard. In its majestic equality, the law allows both the rich and the poor to raise high their political voices. Both are free to hire the best-placed lobbyists and Washington lawyers to pressure public office holders. Both are free to shape public opinion by owning a newspaper or television station. And both rich and poor have the right to engage in multi-million-dollar election campaigns to win office for themselves or their political favorite. But again, this formal equality is something of a fiction. Of what good are the rules for those millions who are excluded from the game? We're taught that capitalism and democracy go together. In fact, many capitalist societies, from Nazi Germany to today's third world dictatorships, have private enterprise systems but no political freedom and plenty of mass poverty. We're taught that capitalism and prosperity go together, and yet impoverished countries like capitalist Haiti, capitalist Nigeria, capitalist Indonesia, the mass of people live in terrible poverty. In such systems, economic freedom means the freedom to exploit the labor of the poor and get endlessly rich, and means little more than that. So transnational corporate capitalism is no guarantee of political democracy. When it works with any effectiveness, democracy is dedicated to protecting the well-being of the many and rolling back the economic oppressions and privileges that serve the few. Democracy attributes equal value to all individuals and seeks to ensure that even those who aren't advantaged by wealth or special talent can earn a decent living. The contradictory nature of capitalist democracy is that it professes egalitarian political principles while generating enormous disparities in material well-being and political influence. Some people think that if you're free to say what you like, you're living in a democracy. But freedom of speech is not the sum total of democracy, only one of its necessary conditions. Too often, we're free to say what we want, while those of wealth and power are free to do what they want to us, regardless of what we say. Democracy is not a seminar, but a system of power, like any other form of governance. Freedom of speech, like freedom of assembly and freedom of political organization, is meaningful only if the free speech is heard and if it keeps those in power responsive to those over whom power is exercised. This is Michael Parenti for Radio Truth.
This commentary was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can find us on the web at lasoundposse.org. The music was Flute Medicine by Synth.
And now for Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present attorney Shana Katadal with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who assesses the Bush administration's legal defense of their warrantless domestic surveillance program. Lori Wallach of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses strategy options for opponents of trade agreements reached at the December World Trade Organization Summit meeting in Hong Kong. And Dr. Ed Lyman, senior staff scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who explains why he's worried about nuclear proliferation if the Bush administration resumes plutonium reprocessing. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In his State of the Union speech, President George Bush made the obvious point that America is addicted to oil. The nation's dependence on natural gas comes a close second. According to The Nation magazine, natural gas heats 45% of American homes, powers 31% of U.S. industry and agriculture, and supplies 14% of the energy used to produce electricity. Currently, America relies on North American natural gas reserves to meet these energy needs. In the near future, the U.S. is expected to join Europe in depending on the top five natural gas suppliers: Russia, Iran, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. The U.S. currently has only 3% of the world's proven natural gas reserves. Russia, with 27% of all proven global natural gas fields, has flexed its energy muscle. It provoked a New Year's confrontation to force Ukraine to pay the market price for natural gas. While Iran is under threat of sanctions over its nuclear enrichment program, the Islamic nation has made deals with energy-hungry countries as diverse as France, Norway, Italy, Japan, and India. Because of diminishing supplies of petroleum and the low-emission advantages of natural gas, the global challenge ahead will be to encourage cooperation over competition to satisfy the world's increasing energy appetite. With the swearing-in of Samuel Alito to the U.S. Supreme Court, the anti-abortion movement is looking for a new battleground. Several groups, including the 300,000-member American Life League, are calling for a full-scale assault on birth control. They object to most forms of birth control, including the morning-after pill. As American Life League founder Judy Brown told the Progressive magazine, pro-lifers must see the connection between contraception and abortion. In early 2005, 30 anti-abortion activists met in Chicago to discuss crafting a position opposing birth control. Joe Scheidler, head of the militant Pro-Life Action League, who in the 1980s led protests outside of women's health clinics, organized the gathering. A follow-up meeting is scheduled for this spring, which hopes to broaden opposition among social conservatives to what is dubbed the contraceptive mentality. Already, right-wingers have attempted to undermine the credibility of condom use by insisting they promote promiscuity. Health experts say condoms are vital in encouraging safe sex practices and protection against the spread of HIV/AIDS. Yet the Food and Drug Administration, under pressure from conservatives, has proposed putting a warning label on condoms. Despite the flurry of activity, major anti-abortion groups, Concerned Women of America, the Christian Coalition, and Focus on the Family, have no official position on birth control. President Bush also remains silent on the issue. In the midst of the U.S. nuclear confrontation with Iran, the Bush administration briefly joined forces with the Islamic State to block the application of two gay rights organizations seeking non-governmental organization status at the United Nations. The U.S. rejected the application of the International Gay and Lesbian Rights Commission, but in 2002, the Bush administration endorsed its application for observer status to the UN Economic and Social Council. In late January, however, the Council rejected the application on a 10-5 vote as the U.S. sided with Asian, Middle Eastern, and African nations. The application for a Danish gay rights NGO was also rejected. In response to the American Anti-Gay Alliance with Tehran, Human Rights Watch sent a letter of protest signed by 40 groups, including Amnesty International and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Scott Long of Human Rights Watch stated, "It is astonishing that the Bush administration would align itself with Sudan, China, Iran, and Zimbabwe in a coalition of the homophobic." In its latest Human Rights Annual Report, the U.S. State Department criticized Iran's use of the death penalty to punish male homosexual activity. Iran's crackdown on gays sparked outrage in Europe when two teenage boys were hanged in July 2005 for engaging in homosexual acts. According to the news magazine In These Times, the teenagers were known in the local gay underground, and rape charges against them were fabricated. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
In a hearing conducted by the Senate Judiciary Committee on February 6th, Bush administration Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez defended the legality of the president's authorization of the National Security Agency's warrantless domestic surveillance program. The program, which the White House says is intended to prevent future terrorist attacks, has monitored international electronic communications involving individuals living in the U.S. since shortly after September 11, 2001. Gonzalez repeated the justifications offered by the president for bypassing existing laws restricting government surveillance. The attorney general said the administration viewed the post-9/11 congressional authorization to use force in Afghanistan as providing the legal basis to bypass the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that requires the executive branch to obtain court orders for all domestic wiretaps from a special FISA court. Other arguments made by Gonzalez for the program's legality included surveillance conducted by previous presidents before the FISA Act was signed into law. Democrats and some key Republicans on the committee were vocally skeptical of the White House rationale. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Shana Katadal, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which, along with the ACLU, have filed lawsuits against President Bush and other top officials challenging the legality of the NSA spy program. Katadal explains why he believes that the Bush administration has broken the law and what's at stake for the U.S. Constitution and the nation's system of checks and balances.
It's a blatantly illegal program. Congress has made all electronic surveillance outside of the Wiretap Act and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act a felony. Usually when you start a lawsuit, you have a great deal of uncertainty about the law, but you're pretty sure you know what the facts are. And here it's quite the opposite. We have absolute certainty that the law is on our side, and nothing, that was said by the Attorney General or by the President in a State of the Union address really changes that. But the big mystery here is really not whether this program was legal, because it's clearly not legal, but rather why they did it and who they were eavesdropping on. Were our clients targets? Who precisely were the targets of this program?
Well, who are your clients, and what's your guess as to the motivation?
Sure. Well, our clients are, a number of, non-citizens, most of them now located overseas, who, have challenged the government's detention and interrogation practices in the war on terror. So, for instance, we represent the Guantanamo detainees. We represent the vast class of immigration detainees swept up right after 9/11 and abused while in detention and then deported, months after they had deportation orders, while waiting in U.S. prisons for the FBI to sort of clear them of terrorism charges. So those individuals are all overseas. And then we represent a man named Maher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was stopped while changing planes at JFK and sent not to his home country of Canada, but to Syria for months of torture. So all those individuals are located overseas, and we need to communicate with them regularly and with witnesses in their cases located overseas and with other human rights lawyers located overseas in the course of, fighting their litigation, their cases against the government. And it's those communications, that we think sort of fit, very closely the sort of profile that the government has given of what they're trying to surveil here. They've said that this program is really targeted against people with some affiliation, no matter how, sort of attenuated or unsubstantiated by any evidence, some affiliation with terrorism. And the government has asserted, again, without any evidence in detaining all these clients originally, that they were somehow affiliated with terrorism, even though they've never been able to back it up with a shred of evidence. And so we think that, given the fact that we litigate these cases, our communications with our clients, with these clients overseas, are precisely the type of communications that the government is probably eavesdropping upon. So that's one reason we brought this case. But then beyond that, the fact that these are the kind of cases that we bring, that we typically sue the government on behalf of non-citizens, often located overseas, the existence of this program makes it very difficult for us to function as lawyers, given that these are the type of cases that we usually bring.
In U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's testimony, he primarily defended the administration's behavior by saying several things, among them the FISA courts were too slow, that the Afghan war authorization granted by Congress included the authority to have this warrantless surveillance, and that leaders of Congress knew about the surveillance but didn't complain.
I mean, the first one, the one that's been heard the most often, has been this notion that the FISA court is just too slow. And that's an absolutely absurd argument. FISA allows the government to put wiretaps in place first and then go to the court for retroactive approval up to 3 days later. So the government has 72 hours to go to the court in these emergency situations and get a warrant. It's pretty minimal what the Attorney General has to do, at the outset, really. They've just got to inform the FISA court you know, they're putting a wiretap into place. And, you know, the Attorney General said today, look, you know, a problem is that, you know, if we didn't have enough information to justify it once the 72 hours rolls around and we go to the court and the court rejects our application, well, you know, then we're supposed to inform the target of the investigation that you know, they were listened in on illegally. But again, you know, that's kind of a strange worry given, you know, how few, you know, requests for wiretap orders the court actually turns down. Then the other argument is that, you know, somehow this authorization to use force in Afghanistan, you know, implicitly gave the president the power to carry out all this, you know, wiretapping on calls that enter the United States. You know, it's very disingenuous. You know, first of all, Congress made, you know, minor adjustments to the wiretapping statutes in December 2001 at the request of the Justice Department, and that was just a few weeks after passing the authorization to use force. So Congress wouldn't have needed to do that sort of thing if it intended to authorize just wholesale surveillance with the AUMF. And then beyond that, you know, in his December 19th press briefing, the first time the administration had really spoken in detail to this program, the Attorney General said that the administration had thought about asking Congress for approval of changes to the FISA statute that would make this NSA program legal. But they didn't ask then for permission because they thought Congress was not going to grant it. They thought Congress would reject them. And so it's kind of disingenuous for the administration to say on the one hand that Congress implicitly approved of this sort of, you know, wholesale wiretapping program back when they authorized the government to invade Afghanistan, while also saying that they thought Congress would not have approved of it explicitly.
Well, just a final quick question here. Beyond the realm of the law and what's happening in the Senate or Congress or even the courts, what do you feel the role of the public here is when our government institutions fail to work, fail to hold those in power accountable?
Most individual congresspeople don't feel like they have an incentive to stand in the way of the executive on national security issues, and I think you know, the public needs to make it clear to their elected officials in Congress that this is an important issue for them. You know, and every time you call your congressperson to complain about something like this, you know, they assume that there are 100 other people out there who felt the same way who didn't pick up the phone. So you've got leverage on your side if you want to send a letter to your congressperson or call them up. But I think it's important that individual members of Congress realize that this is an important issue for the American public.
That was Shaina Katadal, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit the group's website at www.ccr-ny.org. International opponents of neoliberal economic and free trade policies promoted by Washington are now assessing the fallout from agreements reached at the World Trade Organization Ministerial Summit held in Hong Kong in December. Twice before, WTO summits had collapsed in Seattle and Cancun due to disagreements between developing and industrial nations over agricultural subsidies. But in Hong Kong, marked by militant protests by farmers from around the world, a last-minute accord was reached when the U.S. and European Union agreed to cut export subsidies to their farmers by 2013. Many observers believe that India and Brazil became key players in facilitating the Hong Kong agreement when they abandoned their former role as leaders of poor nations that had opposed policies primarily benefiting Western corporate interests in past WTO negotiations. During the 6th World Social Forum held in Caracas, Venezuela in late January, there was much discussion and debate about how progressive activists, poor farmers, and governments opposed to trade liberalization should proceed to effectively resist implementation of the WTO Hong Kong agreement that will next move to Geneva for further negotiations. Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, spoke optimistically of the fight ahead when she participated in a panel discussion at the World Social Forum in Caracas on January 28th.
To reiterate, as a progressive person coming from the U.S., how incredibly inspiring it is to be here in Venezuela, but to also be in South America in proximity to the elections of Evo Morales, to Tavares in Uruguay, to Kirchner in Argentina, to Lula and the project there. And it's inspiring, and I thank all of our brothers and sisters from South America for not just the inspiration, but the lessons. Because in the U.S. is a very gruesome time now, and I will only share that we are fighting
but it is the inspiration of what has been accomplished here, I have to say, that will energize me for many months going back. So thank you very much. I'm going to focus on some of the opportunities for our work together to derail the WTO. The WTO has 900 pages of non-trade rules, one size fits all. We have to think about it really as a very quiet, slow-motion coup d'etat against democratic governance, because it's a global governance system that has strong enforcement. And its rules tell us what our governments can do, who can own and operate services inside our countries. Can they be public? Must they be private? How we spend our own tax dollars for the procurement of our government's goods and services? Who elected these guys? What are even the domestic food systems we can have to make sure people are not going hungry? The rules about how we can use our own land. If your country does not follow these rules, your country is dragged into a tribunal that meets in secret in Geneva, Switzerland, and this tribunal is empowered to rule. It does not matter if the decision is democratic. It's been okay in your courts. If the WTO tribunal says this is not allowed, your law has to go, or you face perpetual trade sanctions. This is like having a gun at the head of democracy if you step out of these WTO rules. So this is now where we are. This is the system. And so the fact that this document, this agenda, was able to get out of Hong Kong alive is a very serious problem. We need to be very clear on the goal. The goal is to derail. This is not an agenda that with a little change can be fixed. And we have to replace the existing WTO. So right now, what we've got is we need to stop the metastases of a cancer. It's going to kill us totally, immediately, if we don't stop the spread. There are many alternatives. We're not against trade, any of us, but we need to get rid of this expansion, get rid of the old system and replace it. There is enormous power against us. There are corporations who are seeking the agenda of Hong Kong, who are pushing every day. They're in our capitals. It doesn't matter if they're based in Japan or US or Europe or Brazil or wherever. They're in all of our countries. And they're in the WTO headquarters. The goal is by the end of December to have a finished agreement. Now, that short deadline is also good news for us, because they have to come up with agreement on about 500 different things. They were in such desperation not to let the whole thing implode that they made this deal, but they had to paper over a lot of really big things that they couldn't agree on. In the end, what we're up against is our governments making decisions. Who can hold a government accountable? The people who can vote them out, or in the case of Ecuador and Bolivia, chase them out. So, coordinating internationally our national campaigns, we can identify a short list of Achilles' heels. They need to fix 300 disagreements. We need just to find 3 to 7 Achilles' heels and then figure out how we all kick in the same place internationally. And that will be the way we derail this agreement. So we're all in this car. And there's a lot of pressure to put us on a road. And we already know it's going towards a cliff. And they want to speed it up with this Hong Kong ministerio. Ladies and gentlemen, compañeras and compañeros, we are the emergency brake. We've got 3 months to pull it. And let's start working. Thank you very much.
That was Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, participating in a panel discussion held at the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela on January 28th. Contact Trade Watch by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.citizen.org/trade. Her talk was recorded by Between the Lines, Scott Harris. In President Bush's State of the Union speech on January 31st, in which he declared that the U.S. is addicted to oil, he promoted another form of energy in these four words, clean, safe nuclear power. But opponents of nuclear power with serious concerns about the technology's toxic waste and high costs say two words unmentioned in the speech are important to factor into the equation of whether nuclear power is going to get a second lease on life in the U.S. Those two words are plutonium reprocessing. Last year, the federal budget included $50 million to come up with a plan for integrated spent fuel recycling facilities, in other words, plutonium reprocessing. It's been promoted both as a means of creating more nuclear fuel and as a way of dealing with nuclear waste. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Ed Lyman, senior staff scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He explains how the process works, why it was halted once before in the U.S., and why he's concerned about nuclear proliferation if plutonium reprocessing goes forward.
The fact that the president didn't mention reprocessing in his speech was anticipated and not unexpected, but that doesn't mean that it's not going to be taking place under the radar screen. In fact, I believe that the president's advisors made a calculation that this was a program that was best if it didn't attract public attention, because so many aspects of it don't make sense or would be controversial.
So how exactly does plutonium reprocessing work?
The purpose would be to take commercial spent nuclear fuel from nuclear power plants to reprocess it, which is perform a complicated series of chemical operations on that spent fuel to separate the plutonium it contains from other constituents and possibly to turn that plutonium into some type of reactor fuel that could in principle be used again. It's anticipated that any such facility would cost anywhere from $10 to $30 billion.
What would be the rationale for any government to do this?
At the dawn of the nuclear power era, it was anticipated that this would be the way to deal with spent fuel from nuclear power plants. In fact, there were plans to go in that direction in the 60s and the 1970s. But the major concern associated with reprocessing spent fuel as opposed to directly disposing of it in a repository like the Yucca Mountain repository that people may be familiar with is that the process extracts materials which could be used in a nuclear weapon. And the Ford and Carter administrations, when they became aware of exactly how much plutonium would end up circulating in the commercial nuclear industry if these plans were actually realized, understood that the proliferation dangers associated with this technology were simply too great to be controlled, and that instead of reprocessing spent fuel and separating the plutonium from other radioactive constituents, plutonium should be kept with those radioactive constituents and spent fuel should simply be put underground. And that has been the essentially the policy of the United States domestic program for several decades. The danger now is that if the Bush administration reverses that policy, not only will it expose hundreds of tons of plutonium in the spent fuel that's now been generated to potentially being diverted or stolen by terrorist groups for a nuclear weapon, but it also send exactly the wrong signal internationally at a time when the non-proliferation regime is threatening to really collapse, and a time when more controls are needed over nuclear materials, not fewer controls.
You've highlighted a very serious concern regarding nuclear terrorism. Can you also talk about the issue of environmental contamination from the intended operation of this process? I understand that a facility that operated in the U.S. several years in the late 60s, I think it was closed down because of high levels of radioactive pollution.
Reprocessing technology itself is also, from a waste management and environmental perspective, the wrong thing to do with nuclear waste, because it takes an object, you know, a spent fuel assembly, which is, although, you know, contains a soup of radioactive elements in it, they're fairly well contained as long as the fuel is undamaged. Reprocessing would expose the contents of spent fuel to the potential for environmental releases by the nature of the process, which is to take the spent fuel, chop it up, release gases and that are inside it, dissolve it in acid, and then subject it to complicated chemical operations which generate lots of radioactive waste and involve corrosive and potentially explosive materials. And there have been some spectacular accidents involving reprocessing waste products in Soviet Union 1957, and we've even had a few incidents in this country. There was one failed attempt at commercial reprocessing in the 1960s at a plant in New York called West Valley. The plant operated only for a few years, had a very troubled operating record, ended up closing and leaving a legacy of radioactive waste, which New York State is still dealing with.
That was Dr. Ed Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the group by calling area code 202-233-6133 or visit their website at www.ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our mid-show music is Evening Stars by Alice Gomez. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you're not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA needs your membership and your participation too. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more, or call the station at 430-WSCA. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We'll be exploring ongoing issues in New Orleans as they prepare for Mardi Gras. We leave you now with this quote from Margaret Atwood. Powerlessness and silence go together. We should use our privileged positions not as a shelter from the world's reality, but as a platform from which to speak. A voice is a gift. It should be cherished and used.